In about 2 minutes, you may feel your eyelids start to get very heavy. You may start to feel very relaxed.
And then you are out. But what happened next in the OR? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
The healthcare data that we provided to build these algorithms is equivalent to, I think, 5 Wikipedias.
You know, we're not really activists. You know, I'm a surgeon, and here it is. You know, there's a mistake happening. You pointed out.
It was not fun. Because they're injecting all this poison in you.
They actually took my PowerPoint projector and smashed it on the floor.
And it will go to an asteroid, a large asteroid, actually, and pick a boulder
off the surface. There's good evidence that people with depression have more information, both in their...
It was never, in my mind, a life or death thing, even when they told me they weren't sure how serious it was.
On today's show, a better way to boil water, a crazy way to get to Mars, and a bit of a gambler's approach to health insurance. But first up, let's start today's show with an installment in our occasional series, Pain in the Neck, where we talk about the annoying or strange things we experience as healthcare consumers, being stuck in the waiting room forever or being told our recovery time will be 3 days when it's really 2 weeks. This edition is about something I think a lot of you can relate to, how we find out what happened during surgery. How did we do? What went down in the OR? So, let's start in the moments right before you go under. You're in the operating room, it's cold, the lights are bright, you're covered with a blanket, people wearing face masks and funny hats are swarming all around you.
We're just giving you some of the medicine through your IV. You just concentrate on taking those slow, deep breaths.
I was taking deep breaths.
In about 2 minutes, you may feel your eyelids start to get very heavy. You may start to feel very relaxed.
And I remember just completely cutting out mid-sentence in my own head. I was like, 10, 9, 8, and then that was it.
The next thing you're going to notice is a pleasant feeling coming over you.
And then you come to.
The next thing I knew, I was in the OR with a cast on my finger.
I remember waking up, and the surgeon was there, and he said, Sarah, we did a hip replacement.
Your operation is done, but what exactly happened?
I had surgery on my foot, and I guess the surgeon told my dad, her foot looks like a baby's foot now. I don't know what that means. So my mom came in, she said, oh, the surgeon says your foot looks like a baby's foot. And I was just like, did they shrink it? What does that mean? So I remember wanting to have a clearer answer.
And there's that sense of, I need all of the information now while I'm groggy. How bad were things, What's prognosis for the future?
So either the info is passed on to family members who might not be that great about relaying what they've learned, or it's passed on to us while we're still really out of it.
We got a call later that night, maybe 6:30, from my doctor. And she said, Sarah, are you okay? I heard that you had a lot of questions. And I said, yeah, I just wanted to know what happened and what you found. And she said, you just don't remember at all, do you? And I said, don't remember what? And she said, we talked about all of this. And I said, well, yeah, before surgery. We talked about what might happen. She said, no. I came in to see you when you were coming out of anesthesia.
Sarah Tebbe, Sakia Gibbons, and Fritz Graham sharing some recent surgery experiences. And we also heard the voice of anesthesiologist Max Kells. I recently had surgery too, and during the follow-up appointment 2 weeks afterwards, my surgeon, John Morris, said to me,
well, I hope you remember that we had at least a brief discussion in the recovery area immediately after the surgery.
Nope, do not remember that at all, not one bit. So I asked him, why can't we get a note that tells us what happened? Maybe one of those while you were out kind of notes off the office past. Turns out there is such a thing. It's just that most of us don't know it exists. We don't ask for it. And it's not usually part of the digital medical record we can access online.
This is called an operative summary. It's a dictated note that describes essentially the technical components of the surgery.
Of course, I asked Morris to print my report out.
It has a relatively standard format. So here it obviously lists your name, your medical record number, the date of the procedure, the preoperative diagnosis, which in your case was a recurrent incisional hernia. The postoperative diagnosis is the same. And under the procedure, I mentioned specifically the size of the defect that I repaired, which in your case was 6 by 4 centimeters. Marlex was the type of mesh that we used. It's an underlay technique, meaning it was placed underneath the edges of the defect.
So is this at all helpful to patients, or do you think it's just when people are kind of curious? It is weird because you're in there and you have no clue what happened to you.
I'm not sure what patients do with this. I think for us it's really about documentation for the medical record. It serves a purpose for billing. You have to submit an operative note generally to get paid for the procedure, and also it's part of the permanent medical record. Mm-hmm. So if there's an issue down the road, so if I have a problem, God forbid you get a recurrence, I can go back and see what I did, how it was done, and if there's a complication.
I had a bruise on my leg. There was like a little bit of blood, and then there was a bruise. What was that from?
I'm going to say without 100% certainty, with 95% certainty, it was probably heparin, subcutaneous heparin, which is a standard of care to prevent clots in the leg during induction of anesthesia to minimize and virtually eliminate the chance of a serious problem with a clot, a DVT, or even potentially a pulmonary embolus.
So I got a little shot in my leg.
And you are not the first person to ask me that. I don't routinely bring it up. It's part of the nursing. I don't mention it. I don't mention it in our preoperative discussion, but this is a big patient safety initiative.
University of Pennsylvania surgeon John Morris, he specializes in hernia surgery, and he was explaining the operative summary to us. So be sure to ask for that report. And also, do you have an idea for our Pain in the Neck series? We would love to hear from you. Is there stuff that really aggravates you, annoys you about your interactions in the healthcare system? Doesn't matter if you're a patient or a healthcare provider. Tweet us. We're at WHYY The Pulse. Elon Musk has been called a visionary and a madman, and maybe he's a little bit of both. A book out this week offers an intimate look at the complicated serial entrepreneur, and joining us now is Ashley Vance. He's a technology writer for Bloomberg Businessweek, and he's written this brand new book, Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. Ashley, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Tell us the story about Musk flying to Moscow to buy a missile.
Yeah, well, around 2001, Elon Musk had made a bunch of money from PayPal and another internet venture. And, you know, he decided that he wanted to spend his newfound fortune on kind of a grand gesture for mankind. And he wanted to inspire people to get interested in space again and in Mars. And he wanted to send either a plant or some mice to Mars. And he decided, you know, he had to get a rocket to do this and that he would go to Russia to buy one on the free market.
And what happened?
Well, you know, he's basically trying to buy this refurbished intercontinental ballistic missile. And so he makes a couple trips to Russia with a couple friends of his. And he would meet with these Russian officials and they would drink vodka and smoke cigarettes. And basically the Russians sort of treated him like he didn't know what he was doing. They thought he was just some dot-com millionaire and that he didn't really know what it would take to space, and they tried to milk him out of a lot of money. And so Elon walked away deciding, okay, I'm going to have to build this rocket myself.
And is that how SpaceX started?
Yeah, that's basically how SpaceX started. You know, originally the company thought they might just kind of assemble parts from other suppliers and do that more efficiently than the existing companies. And then they decided to make everything from scratch in a factory in Los Angeles, and SpaceX was born.
And how crazy is that for a private entrepreneur to get into the space business? It's something that's usually done by governments, by countries.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, I think Elon's well known for Tesla because people see these electric cars on the street and it gets a little more attention as kind of a consumer type thing. But, you know, SpaceX is probably his greatest achievement. I mean, to go from nothing to sending up a rocket in about 7 years is absolutely incredible. When the company started out, this idea that they would be able to undercut the competitors. It sounded like Elon was just was kind of full of bluster, and there's no way he would ever get to the prices he promised. And it's really this within the last year that we've seen SpaceX get very consistent with their launches about once a month. And, you know, the price has held true and they have all the other countries on the run.
But there were some really significant setbacks as well. And at some point, it looked like he was going to lose both SpaceX and Tesla.
Yeah, when SpaceX sent off its first rocket, they do it from this Kwajalein island in the middle of the Pacific. It's essentially sort of Gilligan's Island of space. You've got these people, most of whom have never sent up a rocket before spending 2 years trying to finish off this rocket on this island and send it off, and it blows up a few times, and then finally they have a success on the fourth try around 2008. And then, you know, it's that same period in 2008 where Elon is getting a divorce. It's playing out very publicly in the press. Tesla is heading towards bankruptcy and having a ton of trouble getting its first car out the door. And even though SpaceX now has a successful rocket, the company's struggling to meet its payroll. And these things are all coming crashing down on Elon at once. And he starts having nightmares and really breaking down and has to pull off some heroic financial maneuvers to keep the companies going.
You met with him several times for your book. What can you tell us about his personality? Is there perhaps a story that describes who he is and what his mind is like?
Well, he's this very intense guy. I mean, I think he can be very funny and charming, but you got to warm him up a little bit in the conversation, and then the conversation is pretty intense. So, you know, if you're not sort of keeping him interested with your questions or moving things along, I mean, it ends pretty quickly. He's one of those guys that, you know, I guess his time is pretty valuable, and so you're sort of either keeping things going or you got to go.
What do you think nurtured his entrepreneurial spirit and also his scientific mind and this great way of thinking about innovation?
Well, I think this is one of the things that we see for the first time in this book as well. I mean, I went back to his childhood, talking to his family, and then finding a lot of kids that he went to school with through grade school, and then talking to Elon. And, you know, you find this boy who from a very early age read science fiction in huge volumes, and he read science, kind of clearing out entire libraries and bookstores. And you know, I think this from a very early age, he wanted to go to space. These weren't just stories to them. They were sort of a calling. And his life has essentially been a quest to bring this to the fore. And, you know, he's wired like a scientist. I mean, he's kind of a physicist, engineer type by nature. He happens to be, I would say, much better at the business side of things than some of those people tend to be. And, you know, he's very competitive and all of this together. And you end up with Elon Musk.
What do you think is next for him and for his companies?
Well, he's got these great challenges. I mean, in some ways, Tesla has had this big hit with the Model S sedan, but it's still a luxury vehicle and the company's striving toward try and get a $35,000 more mass market type car out. And on the way, it's got a lot of gambles. They're building this huge battery factory for the car. And so he's kind of investing all the capital that the company has amassed the last couple of years. SpaceX is still trying to really kind of rewrite the economics of space with a reusable rocket. And, you know, so far they're getting very close to landing it, but they haven't landed it quite yet. And then his driving mission in life is to one day get to Mars. And, you know, I don't think he's going to rest until he does that.
Do you think he is motivated by hope for the future, by fear of the future, or is it profits?
I mean, I think money would not be Elon's main driver at all, even though he tends to make it by the boatload. I guess it's hope in some ways and it's fear in others. I mean, the reason he wants to get to Mars is because he sees life on Earth as threatened by a sickness or some sort of natural disaster. And he thinks we need an exit plan and he doesn't really think anyone else is working on it. I mean, you could see a scenario where, okay, you have this colony on Mars and it does sort of give us hope that we could start extending the human species in a real way. But I mean, for the moment, it's just an exit plan and a safety.
Ashley, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Ashley Vance is a technology writer for Bloomberg Businessweek, and he's the author of Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. Coming up, when you make healthcare decisions based on dollars.
Well, let me check my insurance. And, oh, they will pick up that as a preventative care, but only every 10 years. So I'm like, no, I think I'll wait.
High deductible plans, risky gamble, or good deal. Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY. Yeah, that's it. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. That's why they're proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches, to help keep you healthy. And it's why they're proud to sponsor programs and events around the city like the Blue Cross Broad Street Run and Indigo, Philadelphia's first bike share program. More at IBX.com and RideIndigo.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca believes that some of the most exciting innovations arise from external collaborations. With approximately 850 partnerships around the world, AstraZeneca aims to accelerate new ideas into innovative medicines by teaming with distinguished scientists and academic institutions and like-minded science-led companies that contribute complementary technologies, know-how, and molecules. Learn more at openinnovation.astrazeneca.com.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Do you have a high deductible insurance plan? If so, do you also have $2,000 or $3,000 socked away for out-of-pocket costs? For many people, that's how health insurance works these days. You're covered, but until you hit that number set by your insurer, you write the checks. Tanya English reports high deductible insurance plans are changing how we shop for care, and maybe they're pushing the health system to fess up about how much things cost.
New Jersey dad Ray Rizzuto got his first colonoscopy on schedule at age 50. No problem. But when the doctor suggested another routine screening test at age 55, Rizzuto got a second opinion of sorts from his health plan.
Well, let me check my insurance. And, oh, they will pick up that as a preventative care, but only every 10 years. So I'm like, no, I think I'll wait.
Ever since he switched to a high deductible plan, Rizzuto says he's more likely to rein in spending. A deductible is what you, the consumer, pay out of pocket before the insurance company picks up the tab. Rizzuto is a software developer and gets coverage through work. He and his wife have two kids, and their family deductible is $6,000.
It's really hard to kind of manage that risk, which is what we're really doing. We're self-insuring the risk of up to $6,000 per year.
Last year, 40% of insured workers in the U.S. had an annual deductible of $1,000 or more. That's up from about 10% of workers back in 2006, according to a survey from the Kaiser Family Foundation. Each year, when his company offers new insurance options, Rizzuto runs the numbers.
And every time I do it, the high deductible plan still wins out.
It's a trade-off. The Rizzutos have a high deductible, but in exchange, their monthly premium price is lower. They pay about $215 for family coverage each month. In the workplace, high deductible plans are usually matched with a health savings account. Workers add money tax-free, so they'll have some cash on hand when expenses come up. So now, Rizzuto's learning to play the high deductible game. Last year, after the family spent the required $6,000, he decided to finally do something about that carpal tunnel problem in his wrist. Rizzuto had surgery on Christmas Eve, and that was just days before his deductible was scheduled to reset for the year.
I was going to have it eventually. I might as well do it in a year where the perfect storm occurred that I could actually get it paid at 90% rather than out of pocket.
In New Jersey, insurance broker Scott Hayfitz advises people who buy coverage on their own. His clients try to be prudent shoppers, but often can't figure out how much they'll be charged for a doctor's visit.
You know, until the transparency is improved, it's really hard to do it. It's frustrating for them.
And prices vary a lot.
In the world of prescriptions, you could take Nexium, go to three different CVSs, and all three charge a different amount.
In the book called Catastrophic Care, Why Everything We Think We Know About Healthcare is Wrong, author David Goldhill paints a pretty gloomy picture. But he's optimistic about the potential of high-deductible plans to nudge the entire system toward better care at lower costs.
Candidly, you know, all I hear about is, oh, this has been great and here's why I like it. But then again, when you have a CEO who spends a lot of his time advocating for this stuff, I worry that I may not get whatever criticism there is.
Goldhill's passion is writing about healthcare, but he's a businessman at heart and leads the Game Show Network. Most of his workers choose high-deductible plans, but he says that kind of coverage may be less attractive for people who don't have an employer helping them stockpile money in a savings account.
Certainly one alarming piece of data I saw recently suggested that even with the increase in coverage that we've seen, the percentage of Americans who say they put off healthcare last year because of cost, meaning out-of-pocket cost, stayed about the same.
Another Kaiser analysis found that the average deductible across the U.S. doubled in less than a decade, from about $600 a year to nearly $1,200. Consumer advocates say high deductibles have become an obstacle to some patients who really need health care, especially people who buy coverage on their own through the Affordable Care Act marketplaces.
We don't really have enough data, all we have is anecdotes, to know how that's affected treatment.
In Western Pennsylvania, at a gathering of the Pittsburgh Business Group on Health, Jan Klein says she believes those anecdotes from companies that have already switched their workers to high-deductible plans.
Their costs went down right away. Well, why did their costs go down? People weren't getting care. And then a few years later, people were going in with sicker issues because they weren't getting care when they really needed it. We didn't want that for our people.
Klein is chair of the Allegheny County School Health Insurance Consortium. Her group is actually bucking the trend and decided to offer health plans with no deductible at all.
We need our teachers healthy in the classrooms with kids today, every day.
Game Show President David Goldhill says the health insurance industry will continue to stumble as long as real human customers are kept so distant from the cost of their care.
The customer of the healthcare system is the insurer and Medicare.
But high deductible coverage is slowly changing that. And Goldhill says the system is fessing up, becoming clearer about what things actually cost, because consumers have become more careful and demanding.
They're going to walk into doctor's offices and clinics and say, what's the price? And if you can't tell them, they'll go somewhere else.
Or maybe not get health care at all. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
This story is part of WHYY's reporting partnership with NPR and Kaiser Health News, and we're trying to help make it easier for all of us to find out what we're going to pay for a procedure before we actually have that procedure. Check out our Price Check initiative, and please share with us how much you paid for common medical procedures like colonoscopies, mammograms, MRIs, those types of things. Go to whyy.org/pricecheck, submit your information. It's really easy and quick. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Making water boil is not the most scientifically rigorous experiment. Fill a pot, apply heat, and voila, now you can make pasta. But on an industrial scale, for example, in a power plant, more efficient boiling has the potential to save a huge amount of resources. Research taking place at Drexel University is showing early promise toward that goal. Todd Bookman takes us into the lab.
This is a story about boiling water, but we need to kind of back our way into it and instead start with something called the tobacco mosaic virus.
What happens is it kills tobacco primarily, and when the tobacco gets sick, develop this sort of splotchy pattern that looks like a mosaic. So they call it the tobacco mosaic virus.
Matthew McCarthy is no southern farm boy. He's a mechanical engineering professor at Drexel University, where he grows small amounts of tobacco and then infects it with a modified strain of the mosaic virus. Then, once the plants start showing the telltale signs of the illness,
throw them in a blender, and then what you have in the blender is a big soup full of all sorts of plant material, but also this virus we're interested in. And the plant material is much, much larger than the virus, so we can basically just separate it out using centrifuges and sort of chemical separation techniques.
After McCarthy separates out the rod-shaped virus particles, he spreads them around on a surface. Picture swishing them inside of a saucepan. Next step, he pours into the pan a solution containing bits of nickel. Again, swish it around so that the metal mixes and coats and ultimately hardens around each of the individual virus rods. At this point, they're just scaffolding for the metal to bind onto. And this interaction happens on a nanoscale.
They're about a micron tall, and a micron is a million times smaller than a meter. So these things are smaller than blood cells and things like this. They're incredibly, ridiculously tiny, and it just looks like grass. It looks like a surface with a million little blades of grass standing up that are all metals.
There's different ways to manufacture a surface like this, but McCarthy says the tobacco virus is cheap and quick to make, and you don't need to put on a bunny suit. Okay, now that the metallic grass is in place, next step, the flame heats up the water starts to boil, and all those bubbles, the vapor, start rising to the surface. Down at the bottom of the pan, the coating nudges the bubbles off the treated floor. And it does this by sucking water down between the grass.
They're constantly drawing liquid in like a wick, like a sponge that wants to constantly keep the surface wet.
To boil more efficiently, you need a wet surface. You need those bubbles gone from the bottom as fast as possible so that more of the heat can transfer into more of the liquid. If you get a situation where the heat isn't transferring because the bubbles are getting in the way, something called critical heat flux can occur.
And what happens is the surface temperature will increase dramatically, very, very fast, very, very abruptly, because your surface is no longer wet, basically. And that's what happens in a nuclear meltdown.
The reactor gets too hot, and then there's no going back. In theory, the grass-like surface could prevent that. And because it sucks down more of the water, it's also more efficient. Less energy can be used to produce the same amount of steam, which can power a turbine. McCarthy cautions, though, his stuff isn't ready for prime time.
That's far away, though. That's difficult. The manufacturing process, the reliability of these surfaces long term, if you put them on a power plant today, will they still be doing their job a year from now? It's all highly, still in question.
With backing from the National Science Foundation, he's going to keep looking for answers. Beyond power plants, there could be applications for large-scale heating and cooling systems, like in a skyscraper, and in electronics, where computer chips can overheat. But a faster tea kettle is not on the horizon.
Tea kettle, no, right? The issue with tea kettle is when you boil water in your tea kettle, as soon as it boils, you're done. All you're trying to do is get the water hot. So all the stuff we're talking about only works after you start boiling.
After all, that's when the power in a power plant gets made. Look, boiling water isn't the sexiest topic out there, but consider this. Coal, natural gas, and nuclear provide Americans with 85% of our electricity. So even a fraction more efficiency in the process could result in a more sustainable system. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
It's time now for our series, Patient Files, your stories of illness, healing, and coping. In the early days of the AIDS epidemic, the gay community was hit hard. But contrary to public perception, not all were single gay men. Many had families. The children of those first victims have now formed a group called the Recollectors to begin telling their stories. Artist and development director for the Pig Iron Theater Company, Jenny Layden, is part of that group, and she shares her story with us.
When I was 13, my parents divorced, and 2 months later, my father took my brother and I out for dinner and told us that he was coming out of the closet. He said we shouldn't worry because he wasn't going to go running down Spruce Street wearing a red taffeta dress. People always ask me if it was upsetting that he was gay, but it wasn't upsetting that he was gay. It was more upsetting that he didn't live in the same house as me. I began to be more aware of the AIDS epidemic because it was 1983 when he came out, and so AIDS was just beginning to become a cultural phenomenon and crisis. I would see my dad twice a week. We'd have Wednesday's dinner and Sunday afternoons. We'd go to the movies and have dinner. He and my mom had met at Harvard Law School. He was very smart, very organized, always early for everything, very neat, great cook. And he loved opera and Stephen Sondheim. My father asked me to have coffee when I was a sophomore in college, and we met in a coffee shop in New York. And he told me that he was HIV positive and that he had known for 2 years, but he didn't want to tell me or my brother because he didn't want to scare us. He realized that by not telling us, he was depriving us of being part of the process with him. And as scary as it was, he'd rather we know than find out when it was much further down the line. It was terrifying, and I knew enough about the disease to worry that he was going to die really soon. Little by little, he started to deteriorate. It was very gradual, but eventually he got very, very sick. He'd been diagnosed with stomach cancer. He had neuropathy in his feet. Dementia was beginning to start, and he had lost a lot of weight, so wasting was happening as well. At the end of 1995, he was diagnosed with this cancer, which they gave a prognosis of about 3 months for him to live. At the time, he was on an AIDS ward, and the hospital asked him if he wanted to go into hospice care, and he didn't. He wanted to be home. And so they basically gave us till the end of the day to get out of the hospital. Some of his friends and myself scrambled to find a healthcare worker at home and found somebody. We got him home. We got him settled. She was there. And at about 11 p.m., we left, and he told her to go home. And my father was not somebody that was easy to argue with. And she didn't insist on staying. He got up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and he fell down, and he broke his hip. It's indicative of the shape he was in that usually an 80-year-old would break their hip, and he was 55. This time he was on the orthopedic ward, where they were far more accommodating, shall we say, at that time. So that was a disturbing and startling reality, that there was a difference between how people were treated. They tried to do physical therapy, but the rest of his body was sort of a mess. So eventually, after about a week, he came back home. We were giving him morphine, and he was kind of coming in and out of being awake. And he kept checking his watch, which he didn't even have a watch on anymore. I was sitting with him holding his hand, and my godfather was holding his other hand, and just watching him breathe very slowly, and eventually he stopped. When you watch someone die, it's very hard to accept, because you don't want them to. And on the other hand, you have to, on some level, for their sake, be okay with it. He needed to know that I'd be okay. The story of HIV and the story of AIDS is often told about gay men who are single, or maybe they have a partner. The children of, or the families of those people kind of haven't been written, those histories. So it's kind of nice to be able to tell the story and to talk about the experience, because it's important. And for me, it's also a way of keeping connected to my father.
A few months after her father died, Jenny Layden started grad school at NYU. She studied art. Her thesis work drew on old Super 8 movies of her and her father. It was an attempt, she explained, to resurrect images of him as healthy and joyful. To see that art that her father inspired and to find out more about the Recollectors Project, go to our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Jessica McDonald produced this piece. Coming up, the promise and challenges of computerized medicine.
You had a young nurse seeing an order for 39 pills when the correct dose was 1 and saying to herself, this is really weird. And she scans pill number 1 and the barcode machine says, that's not right. The correct dose is 39 pills.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca believes that collaboration with other scientists and organizations can help accelerate new ideas into innovative medicines. Learn more at openinnovation.astrazeneca.com.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. If industries got report cards for how well they've incorporated new technology in the work they do, medicine might get an F. In a world connected by the internet, hospitals and doctors' offices can seem out of touch. But things are changing rapidly, even if belatedly, says physician Robert Wachter. He's written a new book called The Digital Doctor, Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. Robert, thank you so much for being on The Pulse.
It's a great pleasure.
I was out reporting this past week and watched some hospital systems as they were struggling to kind of put their records into a digitized format. And I thought to myself, wow, guys, you're really behind on this. are you just starting now? It was surprising.
Correct. We are just starting now. I mean, there have been computers in healthcare forever. And people sometimes look at us and say, you folks are Luddites. We're not. Go into a modern hospital and there are computers in the OR and there are computers in the X-ray department. But we have had paper records up until very recently. Partly because it's really complicated, partly because the incentive system is kind of screwy and the people who have to buy the systems are not often the people who get the benefit. The federal government put $30 billion behind computerizing American healthcare about 5 years ago, and it has worked. And so in the last 5 years, we've gone from 10% electronic records to 70% electronic records. And it's not an overstatement to say that medicine has gone from a paper industry to a digital industry just in the last couple of years.
Was there another form of resistance, though, to bringing these kinds of records into the practice room?
Yes. Well, I think there were people that were vaguely concerned that it would kind of change the doctor-patient relationship in ways that were not positive. But those were kind of vague concerns. I don't think those were the main reasons. I think doctors often worried that computers would become a vehicle of control, meaning that if I am writing my own notes and writing my own medications on pieces of dead trees, I can kind of do whatever I want to do. Once you have a computer in place, then whoever is behind the curtain can basically mandate that I can only use this medicine and not that medicine, and I can't get this test or that test. So I think there was a little bit of that fear that this would become a vehicle for someone else, whether it's insurance companies, the government, to control the practice of medicine. But what we've seen since computers have finally entered our world is some of the fears were correct, that it has changed medicine in ways. Some of the ways are quite positive, but some of the ways are quite disruptive and even negative.
Has the field been thoughtful in implementing this big change? Sometimes it's you have to do a lot of thinking on the front end and then you design a system. For example, I'm thinking about the fact that records don't talk to each other from hospital to hospital. So,
yeah, that's a fabulous question. And the answer is no, we've not been thoughtful enough about it. But in many ways, it's hard to be thoughtful enough. The experience of digitization of other fields is that, or technology entering any field, is you can try really hard to reimagine what your work will be like in a technological environment, and it's almost impossible to do until you're there. Henry Ford is once reputed to have said, if I'd asked people what they really wanted, they would have said faster horses. They had no ability to understand how their lives would change once there were cars. And I think the experience of digitization in other industries is people put in the computers and often there's something called the productivity paradox, which is they expect to see magic and for 5 or 10 years, nothing happens. And what then begins to happen is the technology gets a little bit better, but people begin to reimagine the work. That has not happened in medicine in ways that need to happen. And you've given one example, which is we've put in a bunch of disparate computer systems that don't talk to each other very well. So I spent 6 months in Boston writing my book, and there's a saying there that two of the famous Harvard hospitals are about 100 yards away from each other. And the saying is, what is the fastest way to get your medical record from one to the other? And the answer is a paper airplane. Those two systems do not talk to each other, despite the fact they are both in the same Harvard system. That's one example. There are other examples that in some ways are scarier. So You might say, here's one of the great advantages of computerization. We will alert the doctor every time he or she is ordering a medication that might interact with another medication. Great idea. Or might be dangerous in some other way. Terrific idea. Well, it turns out the doctors in my hospital get 30 or 40,000 alerts in a month. The pharmacists get 150,000 alerts in a month. In our ICUs, the ICU monitors throw off 2.5 million alerts in a month. And like normal human beings, because 98% of these alerts are false alarms, people stop paying attention. So the premise here, the theory in the digital world is called something called user-centered design, which is the engineers can come up with these great ideas, but you have to then see what it looks like in real work and what happens when people are getting alerted and alarmed all the time, and then redesign it to make sure that it fits the needs. We have not done that well enough in medicine. I think now is the time where now pretty much every big hospital has computers. Most doctors' offices have computers. It's now time to take a step back and say, all right, we're now digital. How do we get this right? And I don't think we've done that yet.
Is there a danger that technology causes you to go on autopilot? I'm thinking, you know, when you have a GPS system in your car, you stop paying attention to directions and you just do what the system tells you. So is there that danger in medicine as well?
Completely. And our systems are still clunky enough that that danger is not fully expressing itself, because that danger becomes very real when the GPS system gets so good that you actually don't need to pay attention. And aviation is seeing that problem now itself. There have been some crashes in the last few years, the most famous one being the Air France flight that crashed off the coast of Brazil 5 years ago, where the computers went on the blink or started giving inaccurate information, and the pilots did not know how to fly the plane. I interviewed Captain Sullenberger, who landed on the Hudson, for my book, and Sully was talking about that case, and he said this young pilot found himself flying a plane he was not familiar with because he only knew how to fly a digital airplane. And we're beginning to see this in medicine. I tell the story in my book about an error that happened at my hospital where we gave a kid a 39-fold overdose. And there were a whole bunch of hiccups along the way that led to it. But at the final stage, you had a young nurse seeing an order for 39 pills when the correct dose was one and saying to herself, this is really weird. But I know to make it to me, it had to go through a doctor and a pharmacist and a robot, and I'll check it against my technology. It's a barcode technology, just like you have in the supermarket. And she scans pill number one, and the barcode machine says, that's not right. The correct dose is 39 pills. And that is just enough for her to say, okay, I guess it's right. The right dose is 39 pills. And she feeds this kid 39 pills. Luckily, he just had a seizure but didn't die. But that, I think, was an example, a scary example of something that is absolutely human, which is as the computers get better and better, humans begin to turn their brains off, begin to be asleep at the switch. And in aviation, they're working very hard on it. And there are actually plans now to switch off the autopilot every now and then to make sure the pilots are still awake and flying the plane. We'll have to do the same thing in our training.
But on the whole, do you still see this digitizing of records as a positive thing, because it will probably help avoid more mistakes?
Absolutely. There's no question. In writing a book, the subtitle of the book is Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. In writing a book about that, I worried a little bit about people branding me as a Luddite. And there are people out there, doctors in particular, who say, pull out the wires, you know, bring back the three-ring binders. I think they're crazy. There's no question in my mind that we have to computerize and that we're at the version 1.0 part of this transition. We will get there. But that doesn't mean that we all sit back and say it's all good, because it's not all good. There are actually some harms that we're seeing. And I think until we address them openly and honestly, think about how do we make this better, which is partly the technology but partly reimagining our work, I don't think we'll get it right.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Robert Wachter is a physician and has written The Digital Doctor, Hope, Hype, and Harm at the Dawn of Medicine's Computer Age. We also talked about what might be next in terms of doctors and technology, what we as patients can expect. We didn't have room to fit that in the show, so sign up for our newsletter, whyy.org/pulse-newsletter, and find out what he told us. For our last story this week, we're going to the gym for a pretty grueling workout. And the people sweating it out have a serious degenerative illness. Colleen Pellissier reports from Falcon Boxing Gym in a northern suburb of Chicago.
The boxing gloves are on, punches are thrown, feet are moving, and brows are beginning to sweat. It's a Thursday afternoon, and boxing coach Sam Rodriguez calls out the workout for today's class.
Heavy bag competition, so we're going to have four people on each side of the bag. Get some distance between you and that bag. You want a crowd. You don't want to look like a rock'em sock'em.
The workout is for a group of people who might surprise you. All of these folks have Parkinson's disease, also called PD, by many living with the disease and people in the medical community.
Your hand wraps. The reason I have the hand wraps is so that when you punch, it makes you turn. Okay, we're rotating here. All right, it's making you rotate. So I want you to go through the full extension, full rotation.
They are all practicing a non-contact boxing workout as a way to cope with a progressive disease. Yeah, you heard that right, a boxing workout for people with Parkinson's. The same sport linked to cognitive delays and possibly even PD. Dr. Elizabeth Zaber is an assistant professor of neurology at Indiana School of Medicine and a movement disorder specialist. She says research shows good things happen to the brain when people with PD exercise.
Animals that exercise release neurotrophic factors, so those are essentially chemicals in the brain that help protect brain cells. Their brains become more sensitive to dopamine, which is the main chemical that's reduced in Parkinson's.
People with Parkinson's have a loss of nerve endings and neurons that produce the important brain chemical, dopamine. The reduction of this chemical is mostly to blame for a PD person's inability to move. Sure, exercise helps, that's not so surprising. But what's so special about a boxing workout? Stephanie Combs-Miller, a clinical researcher at University of Indianapolis Krannert School of Physical Therapy, did a two-year study on the effectiveness of the Rocksteady program. She and researchers followed two groups of Parkinson's patients. One group worked the Rocksteady program. The other group did more traditional exercises, like aerobics or walking.
The intensity of the program and that the expectation that they worked out intensely from the coaches, but also that they were doing it. It was amazing to me. My jaw hit the floor the first time I saw it.
Dr. Combs also found the boxers showed better balance, walking function, and could even reach further. Coach Rodriguez is seeing some benefits of this program as well. He says they are finding support among their fellow boxers and they're getting stronger.
A lot of research goes into medication or cures on trying to help PD patients. Not much goes into the right now. How can we better the quality of life of the PD patients right now? And if I can be a part of that and help them right now, then I'm on.
Falcon Gym, located in a northern suburb of Chicago, is one of several U.S. locations offering the Rocksteady method. The class starts with a walking or jogging warm-up. Then the class rotates through a strength training circuit, a minute or two at each station. After that, the gloves go on and boxers start throwing punches at bags or hand pads.
I'm going to strap up here, med ball at chest level, shuffle, press.
I have been a science nerd all my life. I have never been to a boxing gym ever before here.
That's Tom Moore. He's a 66-year-old retired public defender and a father to four adult daughters. He was diagnosed with Parkinson's about a year ago.
At one point, not too long ago, I couldn't stand up by myself. And it was scary because I would fall at home, have no one there, and be forced to call the paramedics. And I'm just hopeful that I will be able to survive and preserve myself long enough to benefit from some breakthrough that's coming in the future.
He says since starting the boxing class 2 months ago, he can now stand without help and walks more confidently without his cane or walker. His story is similar to many Rocksteady boxers. They get stronger, find camaraderie in their fight against Parkinson's, and begin to show some health improvements. Dr. Combs says during her study, she was shocked to see the demand from the coaches, but more surprised at how well the PD patients responded.
One of the things that I was pleased to find was that the boxers reported a higher perception of quality of life. That's pretty impressive. Over that span, there was a significant difference in those two groups and in the way they perceived their quality of life. There was no difference in severity of the disease.
Back at the gym, the class is getting ready for heavy bag work. In pairs of two, they hit the heavy bag as hard as they can.
Let's go. Let it rip. Let it rip. Come on. Come on, Bob. Five.
As class ends and the boxers help each other out of the gloves, they join Coach Rodriguez, putting their hands in a circle for a final chant.
On three, rock steady. One, two, three, rock steady! Good job.
For The Pulse, I'm Colleen Pellissier.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson, our managing editor. Megan Pinto is the executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, Christine Dempsey, chief content officer. Did you miss some of this show? Any of our previous shows? You can subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes, or you can find it at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That's also where you can get in touch with us, and we do love to hear from you. Send us your questions, your feedback, or your ideas. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a generous leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands gladly support WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.